Simon, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, man. FinTech never sleeps, but my kids do, so we can do this. Let's go.
Let's do it. I'm really excited to talk about the Klarna filing for IPO next year. I thought all I wanted to talk about in this episode was like, who is Klarna? How much are they doing? What are they worth? And then I revisited the backstory of the CEO, Sebastian. So if you're up for it, I'd love to kind of fill you in on basically what I reminded myself of is his kind of crazy story to set the stage of like how we got to the point where Europe's most valuable fintech company is about to go public.
They're about to go public after nearly 20 years. This has been a long old journey. People forget that stuff. Oh, and by the way, they're a bank. Spoiler alert, this is going to be interesting. Let's go.
And the backstory is crazy. So one, I don't think most people know that Sebastian started the company 20 years ago. But two, he just has a great underdog story. So his parents fled communism in the 80s, moved to Sweden, didn't have a great childhood. His father was an alcoholic, committed suicide, I think, when he was in his 20s. Family was often, you know, eating just Swedish pancakes for, you know, a week or two at a time. He met his co-founder flipping burgers at a Burger King. He founds the company in 2005. The very first round they raise, $60,000 round for 10% of the company. That's a 600K post. And here's the thing too, which I've forgotten. They were profitable for their first 16 years in business. You talk about how capital constraints force you to be efficient and effective. And for those of you who aren't familiar with Klarna, they're BNPL, but they have much more global footprint than Affirm. So they've got about $100 billion in GMV versus Affirm's, call it about $30 billion GMV. But Klarna has 600,000 merchants on network across 45 countries, whereas Affirm is mostly just US. So that's kind of how to think about it, but just a very different backstory. You know, Max Levchin is ex-PayPal mafia, like, out of Silicon Valley royalty to some extent. And then you have this, you know, Swedish entrepreneur who's flipping burgers and raising 60K and builds a profitable company. And then turns out the company hasn't been profitable for a long time because they made a big push into the US. That's been a big, maybe a little bit of a debacle, maybe not. We're kind of see. Now we're starting to get caught up where, okay, raise a huge round from SoftBank. At peak, they're valued at like $47 billion. Now their stakeholders are holding their shares at about a $14 billion valuation. Still the biggest European fintech, about to go public. So what does that mean for like fintech, for the ecosystem, how that's going to look like? So anyways, I just wanted to touch base on, I think if you know Sebastian's, I think not enough people know his story. And if you do get to know his story, you're kind of rooting for someone who's come a long, long way.
A long way. So Klarna was big in the UK before it was big in the US. Think Adele and Ed Sheeran, right? But actually not homegrown, but from Stockholm. So maybe more ABBA. And this is a huge story of market entry. The same thing happened to Adyen, by the way. A massive company doing really well. European success story, founded around the same time. And then it makes a big push into the US and its profitability dips. And everybody goes, oh, you see, we told you this was never going to be profitable. And I'm looking at it and going, this business was profitable for most of its life. And I see fintech analysts in the US scene going like, oh, look, they're not profitable. And I'm like, guys, you know better than this. They've been around. And then I realize, oh, no, wait, you don't. You've not been following the story. So, Rex, I'm super glad you did that. And you kind of buried the lead a little bit with the down round, right? Like the fact that they were valued at over $45 billion, then they were dropped to $6.7 billion. This was in the barest of bear markets for fintech in 22, 23.
I think maybe even 4.7. But yeah, way down from peak.
Wow. And so this was proof that fintech was dead. It was never going to be profitable. Public comps were way down. And now there are rumors of the IPO being somewhere closer to 20. So what a comeback story. And what a story about the difference a year can make when you start to deliver on those results. So they're heading for IPO, but, you know, they're on Affirm's turf. And Affirm has been in public markets for a while. They've been telling their story for a long time. They're heading towards profitability. And here's the fun fact. Affirm is going the other way. So Klarna's biggest market until very recently was the United Kingdom. Guess who just knocked on the door of the United Kingdom?
I'm assuming the US is what you're going to tell me.
A firm, Max Levchin.
The other thing you're telling. So a firm is coming in. Yeah.
Yeah. So it makes me kind of wonder, like, are we going to have like two global BNPL players or at least transatlantic players? Because I think for the fintech scene, we've certainly got two big brands that are going to be in public markets where the US market is such a huge piece of it. But actually, the European market is really, really important and has proven, you know, you can be profitable for quite some time. So they're going to be fighting each other and they have kind of similar models.
They do. And I think, you know, one thing about the Klarna backstory is just like your job is never done as a CEO. You know, you start and it's hard. You grow for a long time, it's hard. You launch a new market, it's hard. You get to a huge valuation, then you do a huge down round. Then you have to like claw your way back to profitability. So there's just a lot going on. Also, Klarna's had a bunch of board drama recently. They had two Sequoia partners. One tried to push out the other. Michael Moravec, who's one of the founders of Sequoia, that turned out not to happen. They also recently pushed out another board member who was close to one of the other co-founders. So like there's just always stuff going on. And this is a 20-year journey. But to your point, to compare them and think about them with respect to a firm. So one, we've talked about Klarna being more global, having higher GMV. They've also got about 4,000 employees, whereas a firm has about 2,000 employees. A firm's average order value is north of $300, whereas for Klarna, it's about $140. So they're like, you know, they're different shapes of businesses, and they're both not profitable right now. A firm is trying to be profitable end of 2025, and I would imagine the story for Klarna is something similar, although they haven't, you know, they're going to go into a quiet period, so we aren't going to hear that much about exactly where they are. But this is also what you're starting to talk about is, you know, like, what are the big bets that Klarna is going to make to have the best possible story to tell at IPO? And this is what we've talked about before with Sebastian, is he's very good at the storytelling. So maybe why don't you dive into some of the stories he's been telling about how he's going to get more efficient and lean.
Yeah, so every other week he's talking about something they've done with AI. And whether it's the new generative AI-based chatbot is doing the work of 700 agents, and it's doing it, instead of taking 11 minutes to resolve a customer query, it's taking 2 minutes. And within those 2 minutes, satisfaction is higher, and it can speak 35 languages. That's a pretty good hire to get. But they're also using it for a lot of their marketing. They're also using it in their engineering. This has become the case study, and they've now claimed they're going to rip out Salesforce and Workday and replace it with a lot of AI tooling to get efficient in the back office. So, you know, we talked a little bit about that Is SaaS Dead and OpenAI episode a little while ago. Klarna is the case study for at least they're trying, and it's hard to tell how much of this is true and how much is going to be delivered. There's a little bit of like a wink and a nod to trying to be Elon here and being the shit poster in chief and kind of owning that space a little bit. But there's also really something there. So I should say I've sat with the CTO before and been through some of their projects, and there's a really serious momentum and energy going behind it. And when I speak to bank CEOs and you know, CXOs, they're all like, how's Klarna doing it? How's Klarna doing it? Like, everybody wants to know how they're getting this done. And that's for a good reason. So yes, they're winning at the PR story, and it helps to be telling the market, look how efficient and look how much we're cutting costs, at the same time as having an AI story. And when you're heading into IPO, it's pitch perfect. It's almost too pitch perfect, but what it's done is it's successfully convinced everybody that, like, that's not a European company, that's just Klarna. They're from here, aren't they? Kind of like Nubank has done it. You know, like how everybody in the US knows who Nubank is?
And Sebastian got on a plane, flew to meet Sam at OpenAI, was like, hey, I want to be OpenAI's test case for, like, doing the most we can. And they made that big splash saying we're going to get rid of 700 customer support agents, which they're in a company of 4,000 employees. They want to get that down to 2,000. You know, this is very rough math, but, you know, say 100K per employee, that's 200 million in saved expenses. And they burn 400 million, I think, were their losses end of 2023. So it's a good way of closing the gap towards profitability, especially you layer on growth. And they're also talking about, you know, this was a tweet recently, I want to have zero negative, like, customer experiences or customer complaints because AI is resolving things faster. and in a way that makes people happy. So he is a good salesman. And some of the stuff seems to be material, but like we'll see the extent to which that's real once we have more data and more time.
And I think there's a little bit of founder mode in there. I hate that phrase, but it's sort of true. And it's sort of done with a Swedish genteelness to it. And his tongue is always planted firmly in his cheek. And I think that's kind of why he gets away with it. It's not quite as odious as some of the folks I may have mentioned a minute ago. But what I
mean, if you pull up his Twitter profile, it's him doing a split and people combing the hair of a unicorn.
It's all about the smooth. The background. Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty intense. Yeah. I want to come back to your like $140 versus the $300, because I always canonically think about a firm as being somebody's buying their Peloton on it. You know, like it's what you're using a firm for. But you're using Klarna for the shopping. You're using it for kind of a shopping app. And they were one of the innovators of the shopping app. Affirm does this too. But one of the really big value propositions of BNPL for a consumer is that, yes, okay, I get control and I get to buy the thing and I get to manage my cash flow. And if I do it in time, I get to potentially pay 0% on it. That's amazing. But for the merchant, there's a couple of big things. It's actually more expensive to use BNPL than it is to use cards, because using a card, it'd be like 3% of the transaction, something like that. If I was going to use BNPL, it might be 6, 7%. Why would I give up all of that percentage? Well, you're much more likely to convert at checkout. I'm going to get more customers and they're going to spend more.
Yeah, increases conversion and AOV, average order value.
So I'm going to spend more and it's more likely to convert. But here's what the shopping app does. It's also going to bring in new customers to the site in the first place. You're going to get that discovery benefit. So you're going to fill in the top of your funnel and you're going to reactivate them and bring them back. So this is something they've done that is really, really powerful. And Klarna can honestly take credit for sort of being one of the innovators on that. And then because they have a banking license, they also offer deposit products and savings products, and now they're even moving into subscriptions. So you can use Klarna, and you can actually pay them an extra $10 a month to collect loyalty rewards, to have a higher yield. So they're using this like BNPL as a wedge to potentially wrap themselves around a consumer in a completely different way. So I think, you know, at one point we thought, oh, is it credit cards versus BNPL?
Yeah, there is an open question, and Affirm has been telling this story for a long time. We want to have a first-party relationship with our consumers. And a lot of people don't realize it, but 25% of Affirm's orders are actually driven through the app. And then what you're saying is also true. Klarna has their subscription product. It's $8 or $10 a month, but you get back in credit with their merchants that amount of money. So they're trying to become like a first-party relationship. And then both of them are launching cards. The cards have slightly different flavors. For Klarna, it's more of a traditional credit card. For Affirm, it's this debit card where you toggle a thing and now it's a BNPL on the back. But yeah, both of these things are trying to build more sustainable businesses where they're more of a marketplace with first party consumer relationships.
I wrote a piece a few months ago called BNPL is good, I will die on this hill. And the CEOs of both companies were like loving it. And not surprising, but I think what that did is it spoke to the scar tissue of them being forced to defend BNPL. For whatever reason, it's got a bit of a dirty word. I think the bank lobby has done a really good job of going, oh, that's going after vulnerable consumers and it's not regulated and all of this kind of stuff. So I decided, right, screw it. I'm going to go look at the data and I'm going to go look and see if we can find any empirical evidence of consumer harm. And the empirical evidence actually says the opposite, that on the spectrum of risky lending products, you might have like payday loans way down here, loan sharks, which you just want to stay away from. And up here, you might have like a credit union. You're friendly next door. They're going to give you a cuddle and you can see them. And then somewhere in the middle is BNPL. And just off to the side of that is revolving credit. Revolving credit is just this like slippery slope that just can kind of tie you in knots and become a bit of a trap in a way that BNPL used correctly doesn't have to be. BNPL, though, is starting to introduce late fees. And so this is, who knows, you know, profitability may take them down the way.
There is a question whether these two things converge, but absolutely, if you look at credit cards versus BNPL. Credit cards are intentionally trying to get you to revolve with lack of transparency. They're having late fees. Like, there are a lot of issues with cards. And to the extent you can substitute people into a better form of lending, I think that is net good. People get upset because they're like, why are people borrowing money? This is the world we live in. You want to have honest products that do what they say on the label and that allow consumers to do, you know, buy things that they want to have. So this is the world we live in.
So I want to ask you something, Rex. As somebody who looks mostly at US companies, you know, and you've got this sort of European company and choosing to list in the US, why do you think European companies, because we saw Arm, the chip maker from the UK, listed in the US as well. What is it about the US capital market that's seen as being, I want to get there? What is it about investor appetite? What do you think led Klarna to that decision?
And listing in the U.S. is different from deciding to launch the U.S. market as a European country. And I think a lot of people list here because we have the largest, deepest capital markets in the world. We have the Delaware Court of the Chancery, which has like good understanding in terms of how things are typically litigated. And you just have these natural network effects. In part, that's a brand halo. It's like you're listed in the U.S. on the NYSE or on the NASDAQ. And so markets have natural agglomeration forces. And then the other thing is the U.S. is starting to outstrip Europe in terms of economic growth, productivity growth. And so to the extent you want to be in the world's largest, most liquid capital markets, that's probably only going to be more the case in the future. So that's why people would tend to list here. There's more depth, and then you have those natural network effects. So I think that's generally a good idea and makes sense. The question of like, should you go hard at launching financial products in the US? I totally get why people do it for similar reasons. Large unified market, relatively good rule of law compared to some other countries like in India or China who might just say like, sorry, you don't exist anymore. But it's hard. It's hard to launch stuff here. As we saw with...
Well, look at Monzo, look at N26, look at Revolut. You know, the companies have done really well in different markets, but have struggled to break the US. Like, there's a reason, you know, in the UK, we talk about the Beatles and Adele and Ed Sheeran so much. It's like, yeah, a few of you made it, because there's a lot of us that didn't. It's really hard to crack the US if you're outside it. And the mere fact that you talk about domestic versus international, whereas the rest of the world talks about geographies, because the home market is so unbelievably large and complex, this is underestimated. But I do think it works the other way around as well. Like this one bucket of international doesn't exist. In fact, there's no such place as Europe. There are 27 member states and the UK next to it. You know, like that. You might as well be going state by state with your licensing. That you don't get to passport particularly well. So you want to go get that 500 million market, but the spending power is not quite the same. The earnings growth is not quite the same. They need a different. You got a whole bunch of new regulators. You got more languages to deal with. Like, Europe's hard, man. Europe's very, very difficult to crack. So I'm curious as an observer to see if a firm can crack the UK. Robinhood seems to be doing.
Yeah, I think in launching the UK. Which is an English-speaking country with some norms that are a little more like the U.S. It's very different from, you know, launching U.S. generally. And they're also firms trying to go deeper. You know, they have a business. They have a partnership with Amazon where they're helping underwrite sole proprietors. Now, sole proprietors are effectively consumers, so it's not that big of a difference. But, you know, they're going deeper here. But when I reflect on IPOs, one thing I like to think about is, you know, one of the big things you want in an IPO is a company that is telling a really good story about growth. Median growth for the public market is about 20%. And so if you want to be above that, have 30, 40% growth, you have to have convincing stories about how that is going to be true. They're already live in the US. I think the point you made earlier about launching the US is, if a European company is about to do an IPO and their big growth story is we're going to launch in the US, like, caution, profitability suffers, like all these things happen. That's not part of this story. That's something that's already happened. That's underway. I think this story is cost efficiency through AI, reducing headcount from 4,000 to 2,000 folks, right? And that's maybe $200 million of savings plus maybe a better consumer experience. Two is the growth of subscriptions. They've got 100,000 was the last disclosed number. So they're doing, you know, 100 million-ish or, you know, something like that. Less than that. But like, that's another big push. But you also want to see what like the repeat behavior is and how that improves net revenue retention on a cohort basis for folks who are subscribers versus not. And then the other big story is probably the card, the extent to which you can build a card and think that is something that can drive up your, you know, effective ARPUs. I don't know if you think there's another kind of growth story that people should be paying attention to.
The payment button and the wallet. So both Klarna and Affirm are now available inside the Apple Wallet. And there's the direct-to-consumer play, I'm your app, I'm going to slowly become your financial institution, I'm going to give you this card. Where Affirm is going with their card is they're one of the first in the world to use the Visa Flex credential, which, if you remember, the Visa Flexible credential is like this technology from Visa that lets you attach any other card or even any other payment mechanism in the US, like ACH, to any one card. So now I've got one card to rule them all and in the darkness bind them. And that is really extremely powerful if you want to be the top of wallet or the wallet, right? So the Affirm card could be your card that puts all your other cards together. So I'm spending with this one card that I take out on my mobile wallet, but actually I'm collecting my Chase Sapphire points or my Air Miles or maybe something else, some other benefit, or I'm getting discount for using Pay by Bank. That's a really interesting model that they're trying to own it. The Klarna example is like, well, we're going to give you shopping and rewards, and then we're going to give you yield. Maybe they'll do something there. But they're also showing up inside the Apple Wallet. So they're trying to have it both ways. It's like, am I a payment button for merchants? Am I the wallet, or am I in everybody else's wallet? And they're like, I'm all three. So I think this wallet wars thing is going to be really interesting to watch.
Yeah. Who owns the consumer and has the strongest consumer relationship is super interesting. And we're in this weird, messy middle where it's like Apple has something, Android and Google. Well, Google had like four things. Now I think they have one thing finally. And then Affirm and Klarna, they want to do, you know, own more of the customer relationship, but they're also distributing through merchants and through wallets. And maybe that's okay, but maybe they need to have more of a first party relationship. We talked about Robinhood, how they're bundling in, they have the gold subscription, they're bundling in a credit card. So we're having a lot of people experiment with new bundles. And these companies themselves, you know, Klarna, 20 years old, Affirm, close to that. Robinhood, you know, I think is 14 years old. So these companies are making big bets about how they grow that. And we're still in the messy middle of seeing what it'll look like. Not to mention, hey, someone might come along and create a whole new bundle for consumers. I'm looking for things like that as an investor.
I posted on my newsletter last week. You remember that slide that CB Insights did of like the Wells Fargo homepage? Let's see if we can find it, and I'll send it to you.
Talk about it all the time. Yeah, that was FinTech 2014.
It's like every FinTech attacking different products, and it's like the great unbundling of a bank. Well, now what we're seeing is the great rebundling, and it's being rebundled inside of wallets, because now my Apple Wallet not only has like all of my cards, but it also has my airline tickets and my loyalty cards, and maybe it's even got my driver's license. And I think really when it comes down to it, it's the battle for like being your payment instrument is also the battle for your digital identity online. And whoever gets to own that gets to a really interesting space. But there's the strategy story behind the scenes. I still am some friends with some of the big strategy consultants, although I managed to annoy the certain MUT consultants enough that they don't talk to me anymore. But what the strategy consultants have spent the last few years doing is teaching the fintech companies how to cross-sell. And that cross-sell imperative is how you get to profitability. And that's what we see with Affirm. It's what we see with Klarna. There's this generation that are either just IPO'd a few years ago or about to IPO, and everybody's on the hunt for that profitability and growth in consumer. And it's fascinating to watch.
Yeah. My hot take on where the rebundling happens is it gets rebundled around wealth managers. I feel reasonably confident about this for wealthy individuals, people with more than a million investable assets, because a 1% AUM fee is incredibly sticky. high gross margin relative to other fee streams and financial services. And now that AI is automating other things like, you know, tax prep, various forms of advice, you can start to bundle more inside of an RIA. There are also great platforms that make it a lot more efficient to run an RIA. I'm an investor in Altruist, for example. I think that might even be true for the mass affluent folks with 250K to a million in assets. This is a little bit of what the Robinhood story is, right? They're kind of a wealth manager is too strong of a word because their average account balance is 5K, but they're using the brokerage revenue stream as their core profitability engine to bundle other things into. And so that might be interesting. Maybe they are able to move up market into mass affluent.
The amount they're giving you to switch your 401k is unbelievable. Like the offer to switch it's incredible. So they're really trying to become that without question. Like the market is wide open for somebody to own the mass affluent bundle. And the Citis, the Wells, the Chases that own the mass affluent today are not doing a good job of it. So there's a gap for somebody to do.
Yeah, it's a bad checking account, a pretty good credit card with pretty good rewards, and then disjointed connection to mortgage and disjointed connection to brokerage. And so people are going to try and put those things together. The mortgage thing is a really hard nut to crack, but it's so disjointed that I'm not sure most banks actually get that much credit for having it. Like your relationship discount, if you're a Bank of America customer, is like 12.5 bips or something. It's just not... It gives you no true loyalty on that front. Anyways, that rebundling is going to be interesting.
No, you know what's funny? I've done some work looking at the amount of financial institutions in Europe and the UK and a little bit in the US. I need to get newer data where the person who owns the checking account, how often is it that they actually own your mortgage too? And it's very rare. They're sort of the bank of record for your mortgage. There's something like 40% of customers have more than one product with their main checking account bank. It's incredibly low. What the bank has is a lot of customers that take mortgages and a lot of customers that take checking accounts, so they can fund their balance sheet. They're just not the same customers the whole time. So there's this misnomer that like you get your checking account with a bank and you get the mortgage with them and you're going to be better off. No, the bank that sees your checking account probably sees your mortgage payment go out, but they might not be the lender to you. They're lending to somebody else.
And to bring this back to Klarna, you know, you might have a subscription with Klarna. You might even shop through their app, but are you going to get a credit card too? Or are you going to start to bundle more things in that subscription or not? And maybe they'll be fine even if you don't end up doing that.
But I think there's something about these whales client. Maybe let's say 10% of your customers take everything from you and pay the high-end subscription. They're going to be 80, 90% of your profitability. So it's still worth doing it.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. I'll tell you one other thing I'm excited about for the Klarna IPO is Sebastian's a great storyteller. And reading about his backstory, I learned that his first job, well, he was a burger flipper and then he did some elder care, but his first job was a sales job selling internet subscriptions. And he talks about how he just loved honing the narrative of a sales pitch and how one day he closed 16 deals in a row. And then after that, one of his next sales job was for a factoring company, which is essentially B2B BNPL, which that's how you can kind of connect, I think, the through line of, you know, sales to sales with insights into BNPL to launching Klarna, taking $600K investment and then building, or $60,000 investment and building a European fintech giant that was profitable for 16 years and still might, you know, will likely do a very, very successful IPO. So.
Well, good luck to those guys. BNPL is here to stay. It is not a flash in the pan, as many bankers were trying to convince me about 5 or 6 years ago. And it is probably one of the most disruptive innovations in fintech. So seeing it do well, I think, is good for the whole category. Seeing IPOs come back is good for the category. And there's going to be a lot of folks now watching how this one goes and thinking, you know, can I follow that? Who's going to be second, third, and fourth? Because I think we've got our candidate for first.
Yep, it's going to be very interesting to see. Well, awesome. Thanks for coming on. We'll have to catch up when they do go public.
Oh, we'll be back. We'll be back. Thanks,
that'll,
Rex.
That'll be a good convo too. All right, cheers.